Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Before today's episode begins, I want to give you a bit of a warning. This may very well be the most confusing episode that I've ever put together. Erica and I spent the week gathering up every bit of case material available on the alternate suspect in the investigation. Our hope was that when put together and cross-referenced, we could make the chaos make sense. What we learned through the process is that the chaos, well, it doesn't make sense. It's just chaos. You're going to hear some names that you know, some new names, changing stories, and me gradually getting more and more frustrated as we move along. I'm only giving you this warning because there's going to come a time where you're feeling confused. Just know that it's not you. The data itself is confusing and conflicting. Probably a more apt title for this episode would be Everybody's Lying. Good luck, and Godspeed, here comes Episode 8, The Alternate Suspect.
I'm anything to lose. I have no secrets to hide. I could just be blunt, and people could judge it however they judge it.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. At the crime scene, in the minutes and hours after DeMario Lowe's was killed, rumors were spreading immediately about Jody Hill. It seems like people in the neighborhood believed that Jody had been part of the robbery attempt 2 days prior, and we know now that they were right about that. So folks started connecting the dots. Maybe Jody was responsible for the murder as well. It's hard to say at this point if that idea came from the people on the street or from the police on the scene. One way or the other, Jody's name came up quickly. But despite the fact that everyone around the scene that night was talking about Jody, in the days and months following, there was another name that kept popping up. Carvale Miles. There are two things that I'll say up front. One, Jody has always suspected that Carvale was responsible for Mario's murder. And two, I don't see a good reason to believe that he was. I just don't see the evidence to connect him to the killing. What does exist, however, is a lot of rumors, which is what has always stuck with Jody. So much so that even when the DNA results from the shell casings came out, that still wasn't enough to sway them from their theory. I just talked to Jody about this earlier this week, and they just said that it's hard to make sense of it because everyone Jody talks to on the inside is saying that it was Carvale, but the DNA comes back to a person Jody has never even heard of before. I think that it doesn't make sense for the same reason that it doesn't make sense that people were saying that Jody was the killer. It's just people talking, making assumptions, restating rumors as facts. Now, that's not to say that I know Carvale had nothing to do with the murder. I just want to make clear that I don't see a clear case for it. The evidence just isn't there for me. So what I'm going to do today is share with you all of the evidence that does exist that indicates that Carville Miles has some connection to the case. It's both a lot and a little all at the same time. We'll start with the attempted robbery on the 13th. Last week, you heard directly from Jody, and they shared their version of how that event transpired. In Jody's version, they were at the party store with Leon. Leon tried to rob Mario. At that point, Jody showed up and held a gun to Mario. Leon fled, and Jody fought over the pistol with Mario until Sturgill arrived, and Jody ran to Carvale's house. After that, Carvale gave Jody a ride to their car, and they never spoke again. Carvale had a different story, and he shared it with the police on the day of the robbery. But before we get to his statement, let's go back to ground zero. The moment that the idea of Jody's involvement first showed up in both the murder and the robbery investigation. It does not appear that before this there was any effort whatsoever to figure out who that second robber was. All of this happened before McGinnis even arrived on the scene that night. In Detective McKinney's report, it says that he got a call to head to the murder scene at midnight. The first thing that he did when he got there was speak to Officer London. He was the one who caught Leon Newcomb as he was fleeing the robbery attempt. The very first thing that McKinney writes in his report is that London informed him that the car at the crime scene was the same car from the robbery and that he believed the victim in the homicide was the same victim from the robbery. So right away, before McKinney spoke with anyone at the scene and before he interviewed Victoria Miles at 12:30, the investigation was already connected to the robbery. But that's not all. While reviewing this report, I noticed another problem with the already problematic robbery investigation. In this report, it says, quote, Sergeant London advised that he and Officer Sturgill were able to seize a .22 caliber revolver handgun and two 20-gauge shotgun shells that were located inside the victim's vehicle, end quote. Anyone else see a problem with that? We knew that the .22 was collected at the robbery. And according to Jody, in the original police report, it said that they also found shotgun shells in Leon's pocket. But in this report, it says that the shotgun shells were found inside Mario's car. First of all, it was a single-shot shotgun, so it's not like the shells would have been ejected in a struggle. So why would they be in the car? And secondly, if they were found in the car, that would mean that Sturgill and London searched the car and somehow completely missed the actual bright gold shotgun that was sitting there, but found the two little shells. I don't believe that for a second. It's not a huge deal, but it's just another instance of the police reporting proving to be false and inaccurate. And Jody's reporting being the story that rings true and actually fits with the evidence. And on that note, and I apologize for the aside, but I literally just pieced this together while researching this episode. Some of you already may have seen this on social media. But in regard to last week's episode, and the discussion about Officer Sturgill lying about IDing Jody at the robbery, I noticed another huge discrepancy, a very obvious one, actually. Not only do we know that Sturgill didn't ID Jody because Jody was actually the person who was fighting over the gun, but the record seems pretty clear to me that Sturgill never got a good look at either of the two people involved in the robbery. So at trial, Sturgill testified that he pulled up in front of Mario's car. So the two vehicles were facing each other. That put him getting out of the driver's side of the car and the second robber, who he ID'd as Jody, getting out of the passenger side of Mario's car. Since the cars were facing each other, they were both on the same side of the vehicles, face to face. But let me read to you what Sturgill wrote in his original report, the one where no one was able to ID the person who fled from the passenger seat. Quote, as I turned onto Bellevue from Broadway, I saw two black males, later identified as Lowe's and Newcomb, fighting, end quote. And he also wrote, quote, Lowe's stated that when he left, he traveled southbound on Broadway to Bellevue, end quote. So first, Mario turns east onto Bellevue from Broadway, and the robbery begins. Then Sturgill turns east onto Bellevue from Broadway and finds the robbery in progress. That puts Sturgill's car behind Mario's car. And that puts Sturgill on the opposite side of the car from the person who he later said that he was face-to-face with and could identify. But listen to how he changes his story at trial. Remember what his report says, quote, "I turned onto Bellevue from Broadway," end quote. But this is what he said in his trial testimony. Quote, "So you got to pull out of the parking lot, turn down Pipestone, and then turn left onto Bellevue." "Yes, sir," end quote. He completely changed his route to him now approaching from the east instead of from the west, which puts him face to face with Mario's car instead of behind it, which ended up being the basis for his false ID of Jody. So if there are any of you left that still think we need to give Sturgill and the rest of these cops the benefit of the doubt, there you go. Those are his words. Sturgill's testimony was perjury. Period. Now back to our regularly scheduled programming. Before my rant, I was explaining that the first person McKinney spoke to on the scene was Sergeant London, who advised him that the car at the murder scene was the same car from the robbery. Next, McKinney spoke to two bystanders, Andre Williams and Glenda Miles, who was Carvail and Victoria Miles' mother. They both confirmed that it was Mario's car parked in the open lot at the crime scene, and Glenda told McKinney, according to his report, that a person had went to her house and told her to tell DeMario not to show up for court to testify about the robbery or he would be found dead. So right there, McKinney hadn't been on the scene for 15 minutes, and he had what appeared to be a rock-solid lead on the murder. And if all of that is true, you can't blame McKinney and McGinnis for looking for a connection between the two crimes. Mario was robbed. The next day, a message comes out to tell Mario not to show up in court or he'll be killed. And the next day, Mario is killed. It's a pretty damn good lead. Unfortunately, from the rest of the evidence we've seen in this case so far, it seems to have went from a lead to blinders pretty quickly. Rather than taking in the information as a potential path of investigation, it became the only path of investigation. And when the evidence didn't pan out, they just changed the evidence. In practical terms, this lead really wasn't as solid as it was made out to be, in my opinion. I mean, think about it. There was no world where Leon wasn't going down for this robbery. He was caught moments later, and Mario had already ID'd him on the scene. Doughboy was cooked no matter which way you shake it. This was a make-a-plea deal case, if I've ever seen one. And there was really no risk of Jody being identified, nor does it appear that the police were making any effort to do so. At this point, the case documents show that Leon had already told police that he was taking the rap for the robbery on his own, and that he wasn't going to put it on anyone else. And even if the story about Shattis Wells going to Glenda Miles' house to make the threat is true, this is where this all ties back into Carvail. Why would Mario be killed a day later? It doesn't make sense. It's not like Mario passed a message back for Leon to go fuck himself. He wasn't even there to receive the message, and no one has said that they ever relayed that message to Mario. Nobody. So why send someone to tell Mario not to testify at a later trial, that really was never going to happen anyway, and then decide just to kill him? That's of course just my opinion, and everyone's entitled to their own, but the whole motive angle here just does not add up to me. And the reason that I say if Shattis Wells was sent to make a threat is just because the Miles family, as Zach put it to me in the office the other day, is all over this case. Now, I'm not saying it's not true. I have no idea. But for what it's worth, as I said at the beginning, Jody believes that Carvail was involved in the murder. That's just their belief. And if there's any chance that that's the case, then I could see a case for Carvail and his family trying to point the finger somewhere else. Again, I want to stress this. I'm not saying that's what happened. In fact, without evidence, I have to say probably not. But that's why I'm trying to look at all of this through an objective lens from both sides. Now, getting back to McKinney's interview with Glenda, she not only told him that someone made that threat, but she also said that, quote, two subjects approached her son, Carvail Miles, on November 13th and asked him if he wanted to participate in an armed robbery slash carjacking, but he refused. End quote. So there are all the dots connected in just a matter of minutes. Same victim from the robbery, and Glenda Mile says that there were two people that asked her son to participate in that robbery, and the next day, someone came to her house to pass a threat on to Mario. The report says that no names were given, but we know from other witnesses that Jody's name was definitely being tossed around right then and there amongst the bystanders. Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Carvale Miles was interviewed by McKinney a few hours after the murder back at the police station. From McKinney's report, quote, Carvale Miles stated on November 13, 2001, he was at his mother's house located at 392 Pavone Street in the city of Benton Harbor. Carvale Miles stated that between 5:30 and 6 p.m., two subjects he identified as being Leon Newcomb and Joe Hill pulled up in a Cadillac that was dark blue in color. Carvale Miles stated that Joe Hill and Leon Newcomb then got out of the vehicle and asked him if he wanted to do a lick with them. I then asked Carvale Miles, what was a lick? Carvale Miles then answered, a lick is when you rob someone and then take their money. Carvale Miles stated that Joe Hill and Leon Newcomb then displayed two guns that he identified as being a .22 caliber revolver handgun and the second being a sawed-off shotgun. Carvale Miles stated that both guns were spray-painted the color gold. End quote. So, this obviously is in direct conflict with Jody's version of events. In Jody's story, they didn't have anything to do with a plan to rob someone. Now, I'm not telling you which version to believe, I just want to make everyone aware of both versions. What I can tell you is that this interview was the break in the case, full stop. According to the record, at this point the police had no idea who the second person was that was involved in the robbery, and it was Carvale who directed them to Jody. As the interview goes on, Carvale is asked who had which gun. He says that Leon had the shotgun and Jody had the pistol. He then says that he declined their offer to participate in the robbery, but not everyone was convinced that Carvale wasn't involved. Despite the fact that Jody was arrested for the robbery on that very day, rumors about Carvale's involvement continued to spread through the streets. In fact, Carvale's mom mentioned the rumors to McGinnis and McKinney in a December interview. She told them that she had heard the rumors that Carvale was involved in the murder and proceeded to offer an alibi for him, unprompted by the detectives. From that report, quote, "In speaking to Glenda Miles, Detective McKinney and I found it interesting that Glenda offered such a detailed alibi as to the whereabouts of Carvale during the shooting. It should be noted that Glenda was never asked anything about Carvale, and we did not ever indicate that Carvale was a suspect in the shooting. Glenda was very protective of Carvale, despite investigators asking no questions about him." End quote. Even Mario's best friend told police that Mario himself thought Carvale was involved in the robbery. LeBron Tillman was interviewed in February of 2002. Here's that report. Quote, "Tillman stated that DeMario Lowe's was his best friend. Tillman said that the last time he saw Lowe's was about 2 a.m. on the morning of the date that Lowe's was killed. He saw him on Lake Street. Tillman stated that Lowe's told him about the robbery and that he thought Carvale Miles had something to do with it. Lowe's told Tillman that he thought it was very suspicious because he saw Miles at the scene shortly after the robbery attempt, and Miles told him that a light-skinned guy with glasses who lives in the Highland Projects was one of the suspects. Tillman stated that he was friends with Carvale Miles up until the murder of Lowe's. Tillman stated that he knows Miles to sell dope, crack cocaine, for Jerry Blackwell. Tillman stated that Miles told him that Joseph Hill was at his mother's house sawing down a gold shotgun on the day of the robbery. Tillman stated that Hill asked Miles about the robbery, but Miles did not want to participate. Tillman stated that Miles told him that Joseph Hill ran to 392 Pavone after the robbery attempt and stayed there." End quote. So there are a couple things to note in this report. It's another instance where Carvale is saying that Jody and Leon came by his house asking him to participate in the robbery. It's kind of corroboration, but again, the source of the information is Carvale himself. The other thing to take note of, though, is that Mario did not suspect Jody. He suspected Carvale. Based on Mario's best friend's statement, it wasn't Jody that was at risk of being identified by Mario, because Mario thought Carvale was involved. And according to a jailhouse snitch, someone who didn't end up testifying at trial, Mario had good reason to suspect Carvale, because this person says Carvale had robbed him once before. John Bradshaw was cellmates with Jody for a time when McGinnis was investigating the murder. On December 10th, around 4 weeks after the murder, McGinnis interviewed Bradshaw. This is actually the only interview that we have a full transcript for. Like I said, Bradshaw didn't end up testifying, which is a little odd because some of what he said is pretty damning for Jody. But like we see in a lot of cases like this, Bradshaw is claiming that Jody confessed to him. We'll get into what Bradshaw said about the murder in just a bit, but regarding the robbery, he claims that the reason Mario was targeted was because Carvale had already robbed him for some speakers previously and told Jody that Mario was an easy target. From the transcript, quote, "Carvale robbed him for some speakers. That is when they found out that he was an easy prey to stick up, because he was the weed man. He wasn't selling crack cocaine, he was selling weed. That's why Leon was in the car with him, talking to him before he robbed him. They were in a little red car. This is how it was told to me. He was figuring him out, seeing how they were going to rob him, and seeing how much money he had on him. That's what he did. He found that he had that money, and that is when they went to rob him." End quote. Bradshaw also says that Jody had told him that they had gone to Carvale's with Leon prior to the robbery. So that story seems to be pretty consistent throughout. Glenda says it happened, Carvale says it happened, and now according to Bradshaw, Jody also said it happened. In all instances where we hear that Jody and Leon tried to get Carvale to participate in the robbery, the source of that information is Carvale himself or his mother, except this one. Here, Jody's saying it. So what you have to determine is if Bradshaw is telling the truth. I think you'll see when he gets to talking about the murder, it's very likely that this is all made up, typical jailhouse snitch stuff. But even before that, like in all cases like this, you have to consider whether you believe that Jody would just completely unload the details of a murder to a stranger. Well, they weren't exactly strangers. Evidently, Bradshaw knew Jody when they were 4 or 5 years old from a foster home in the city of Buchanan. That's as far as the connection goes, and that's just according to Bradshaw. So the story Bradshaw's giving is that he ends up in a cell with Jody. Jody is saying they're innocent. Bradshaw then makes the connection that he knew Jody when they were a toddler, and so Jody spills their guts. The other thing that you have to consider is that Jody has been to jail before. They know exactly what goes on there. The whole street code, no snitching business is out the window in the county jail, and that's any county jail. Everyone knows that everyone in there is begging detectives and prosecutors and guards to make deals and offering to throw anyone and everyone under the bus to do it. You would have to be incredibly stupid to confess anything to anyone on the inside in any county jail. Especially in a weak case like this one. There's a reason why on our wrongful conviction case submission form on our website, there's a box to check to see if there were any jailhouse snitches involved. It's a telltale sign that the prosecutors and detectives had no case, so they make their way down to the jail and start offering up deals for information. And here's another example from Jody's case that I think we can conclusively say is not true. A guy named Anthony Hawkins wrote to the prosecutor telling him that he had information about Mario's murder. So McGinnis went to the jail to interview him, and this is what he had to say. Quote, Hawkins stated that he had been in 2N with Leon Newcomb on 11-16-01. Hawkins stated that Leon Newcomb told him that he and Carvale Miles had robbed DeMario Lowe's. Hawkins stated that Newcomb told him Carvale got away. Hawkins said that Newcomb told him that he was going to get in touch with Carvale to handle it in the streets, meaning kill him or whatever. Hawkins stated that Newcomb told him this the night of the murder of Lowe's. Hawkins also said that Newcomb told him that he and Lowe's were fighting over the gun, and that Newcomb and Miles had a shotgun and a little gun. Hawkins stated that Lowe's was killed because they did not want him to testify. Hawkins stated that Newcomb did not mention Joseph Hill ever. End quote. Now that would be really damning if we didn't know by Jody's own admission that it wasn't Carvale at the robbery. It was in fact Jody with Leon that night. But you can see how this shit goes. Later in the report, McGinnis says that he checked the jail records, and Hawkins was never even in the same unit as Leon at the same time. So he's clearly lying, but if Carvale's was the person McGinnis was trying to build the case on, you bet your ass that this statement would have been taken much more seriously. The last statement I want to share today regarding Carvale and any possible connection to the robbery is that of Canvas Smith. Canvas makes several statements throughout the investigation. This one came in March of 2002. McGinnis visited her in prison to show her a lineup that had to do with the murder. We'll get to that in the next segment. But this is what she had to say about the robbery on the 13th. Quote, Smith stated that she was loosely familiar with Carvale Miles. She said she has seen him around. She said that she knew that Carvale and DeMario used to always be into it, something about a CD. Smith said that she saw Carvale Miles shortly after the robbery as he stood outside. She lives at an address near the location and came outside when she saw the police cars. Smith said she saw Carvale standing outside also and he was laughing. Smith stated that Carvale mentioned something about Joe jumping out of the bushes. End quote. There really is no evidence at all that Carvale was part of the robbery. He says that Jody and Leon asked him to participate and he declined. John Bradshaw claims that Jody said the same thing, and Anthony Hawkins says that Carvale himself was the second robber, but we know for a fact that's not true. And Canvas Smith says that Carvale was hanging around the scene after the robbery, laughing about Jody jumping out of the bushes, which would indicate that he was there to witness the robbery. The problem is that there are elements of Canvas, Anthony, and John Bradshaw's stories that are all provably false, so it's hard to take any of it seriously. And with Carvale and his family being so connected to the case, along with allegations that Carvale was responsible for the murder, it's also difficult to fully accept the story about Jody and Leon asking Carvale to be a part of the robbery beforehand. Really, in all of this, the thing that I found the most meaningful was LeBron Tillman's statement. Remember, he was Mario's best friend. And Tillman said that Mario himself believed that Carvale was involved in the robbery, not Jody. I think that's really important when it comes to motive. The idea that Mario was murdered in order to stop him from testifying against Jody just doesn't add up. At least according to his best friend, Mario had no idea who Jody was. Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Truth and Justice is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are all things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
There was a lot of roundabout talk regarding Carvale having some connection to the robbery attempt after Mario was killed. But other than Anthony Hawkins, no one claimed that he was actually directly involved. But that's not the case with the murder. There are still people on the streets of Benton Harbor today that believe that Carvale killed DeMario. The most direct statement regarding Carvale's involvement came from John Bradshaw. Remember, he's the one who was housed with Jody in jail and claims that Jody confessed all of the details of the murder to him. Bradshaw claims that Jody told him that there were four people involved in the murder. It was Jody, along with Carvale, a guy named Terrence Hunter, and the fourth person whose name was unknown. So Bradshaw's interview happened in December. He says that Jody told him that they went home after work on the night of the murder, argued with Sherelle, got undressed, and went to bed. I have to point out that I absolutely do not believe that Jody said all of this to Bradshaw. You'll see why in a few seconds here. The story that he's about to tell is provably false, which leads me to wonder, how does Bradshaw have all of these details? Where could they have come from if not from Jody? Bradshaw knows that Jody went home and fought with Sherelle, got undressed, and went to bed. Who knew that? McGinnis knew that, because Sherelle and Jody had both told him that on the day of the murder. Bradshaw knew that Mario was killed with a .45 caliber pistol. Who knew that? McGinnis knew that. Another element that actually did come out at trial was that Canvas Smith, not in her first interview, but in a later interview, told McGinnis that she had seen Jody and Carvale driving around stalking Mario all day up to an hour before he was killed. And here's how that story evolved. Originally, Canvas told the detectives that she was driving around with Mario on the night of the murder. The night ended with them dropping Mario's cousin Andre off, at the crime scene actually, And then Mario dropping her off, saying he had something to do and he'd be back. He was killed 15 to 45 minutes later, no mention of any stalking. Then, in a later interview, Canvas says that Sherelle Moore and Mario had a heated conversation outside of a convenience store on the morning of the murder, and that after Mario picked her up to hang out at 9:30 p.m., so between 9:30 and 11, she saw a blue Cadillac pull up across the street from the party store where she and Mario were getting drinks, and there's no ID of anyone in the car. Then, we jump to Bradshaw's statement a week later, a week after Canvas's statement. And Bradshaw is now saying that Jody told him that they had been stalking Mario with Carvel Miles throughout the evening. Then, McGinnis goes back to Canvas in prison, and now her story changes again. Now, it wasn't just the Cadillac at the liquor store with no ID. Now she says that it was definitely Jody and another person in the car. McGinnis says that he shows her a photo lineup, and she positively IDs Carvel Miles as the second passenger in the car with Jody. And now, it wasn't just the car parked at the store. Now, it was definitely Jody and Carvel, and she saw them following Mario around, stalking him several times between 9:30 and 11 p.m. Now, I know that some people refuse to accept the 12:05 a.m. signout on Jody's timesheet. Whatever. But I haven't heard anyone dispute the fact that Jody was in fact at work that night, that they did arrive at 7 p.m. and they did work late into the night. Some want to believe that they left at 11 or 11:30, but surely no one is willing to accept that Jody was driving around with Carvel at 9:30 stalking Mario. This is an obvious lie and provably false, but when you track the statements, it sure looks like this is a game of telephone. So, Canvas tells McGinnis Jody's car was at the same store as her and Mario. Then, McGinnis talks to Bradshaw, and he says Jody was stalking Mario all night in their car with Carvel. Then, McGinnis goes and talks to Canvas again, and now she changes her story to Jody and Carvel were stalking Mario all night. It's not like I just don't believe the story. We know for a fact it's not true. No one has ever disputed that Jody was at work during this window of time. It's a lie. And when we know we have a provable lie, we then source the lie. Who's the common denominator here? Dan McGinnis. I told you earlier that Bradshaw's story was provably false, even beyond the part where Jody was stalking Mario while we know they were at work. So here's the story. This is what Bradshaw says Jody told him. After Sherelle left to go to the club, Jody got up, got dressed, and went to pick up Carvel, Terrence Hunter, and another guy. They then went to Carvel's sister's house on Broadway, the crime scene, where Carvel gets out and waits on the front steps for Mario, setting up an ambush. Then, Jody and the other two drive up to a party store where somehow they know Mario is hanging out with his car. The three then get out, leaving Jody and Mario's car there at the party store, and chase Mario on foot back to 784 Broadway, where Carvel is waiting for him, and that's when they open fire. When you read the transcript of the interview, you can see that Bradshaw has been given some details, but seems like he didn't know how to put them all together. It also reads like McGinnis is showing him pictures of the guns. So Bradshaw says there were three people shooting. All four had guns, but only three were shooting. They had a .45 pistol, a .22 pistol, and a 20-gauge shotgun. He says Jody had the .45. So you see what I mean? Someone clearly fed Bradshaw some details of the murder and investigation into Jody. The fight with Sherelle, getting undressed and going to bed, the .45, etc. But the story is complete nonsense. Four attackers instead of one, no car in the alley, no calm conversation outside that escalated. Hell, Mario's car wasn't even at the crime scene in this story. Now, the everyone's always guilty crowd will say this is just coincidence, but when I look at it, it's pretty easy to see what could have happened here. Bradshaw gives a damning story, but it's unusable. It conflicts with every bit of the evidence, so he can't testify. But then magically, one element of his story that no one had ever heard before, Jody and Carvel stalking Mario, ends up popping up in a more credible witness's story. I mean, Canvas isn't particularly credible either. Her story changed drastically over the months from she saw Sherelle in the morning, to saw the Cadillac at the party store but couldn't see who was inside, to it was definitely Jody and Carvale inside and they were following Mario around all night when we know Jody was at work. But she was at least an eyewitness. She was with Mario that night. So John Bradshaw's story shifts over to become Canvas Smith's story. And then she testifies. One of the most interesting characters in the story is a guy who went by the street name Beetlejuice. He appears to be the impetus of the dying declaration to Sonia Lucas' story, and may have even been the inspiration for Bradshaw's They Chased Him to the House from the Party Store story. Once a reward had been offered for information on the case, this guy Beetlejuice, real name Tommy Travis, comes forward on December 6, 3 weeks after the murder, and says that he was there on the crime scene when it happened. He says that he was hanging out in Sonia Lucas's living room playing cards with her stepfather, Mr. Lewis, when the murder occurred. I'll give you a spoiler, he wasn't. At all. Sonia, her kids, her niece Connie, who had been at the house shortly before Mario arrived, her stepfather, all said they hadn't seen this man that night. But another interesting conspiracy theory for the haters to hate on. I find it compelling that McKinney is the one who interviews Travis here and gets this incredibly damning statement from him. And then McKinney disappears his interview with Sonia in the search of her apartment from his original report. So anyway, here's Travis's full story in a nutshell. He's hanging out playing cards with Sonia's stepdad. Sonia comes home, eats some food, and goes to bed. Then they hear 6 to 7 gunshots from outside on the north side of the house. They then look out the north side window, where it's pitch black with no lights, and they saw 3 black males running towards the front of the house. At that point, Sonia comes out of the bedroom and, quote, Tommy Travis stated when he, Mr. Lewis, and Sonia Lucas approached the front door, they heard a gunshot. Tommy Travis stated that Sonia Lucas then opened the front door and they observed Joseph Hill and another black male shooting at DeMario Lowe's, end quote. So here we have a perfect clear idea of Jody Hill, who Sonia doesn't know, and Sonia is standing in her open doorway, 6 feet away from the killers, while they're shooting Mario. It was after this interview that the John Bradshaw interview happens, where now, suddenly, there were a group of people chasing Mario and multiple shooters, including Carvale Miles. Then after that, they circle back to Tommy Travis again, and wouldn't you know it, he picks Carvale Miles out of a lineup as the second shooter that he couldn't identify the first time. Now, at that point, McGinnis asks Tommy to take a polygraph, and he agrees, but then he disappears and never ends up taking one. And this is what McGinnis wrote in the bottom of his report, quote, It's difficult to totally conclude Travis is lying or telling the truth. We have not been able to prove that he was indeed at the scene during the shooting. It is not clear whether Travis was indeed present at the scene or he is retelling the story of an unknown witness who has yet to come forward. It should be noted that Travis's motivation to come forward with his statement is that he want to collect a Crime Stopper reward for the information of the homicide. End quote. Are you starting to notice a pattern here? Bradshaw gives a story, but he's not credible. He can't testify because he gives a story that is provably false. He'll be eaten alive on the stand. So, an element of his story shifts to another witness, Canvas Smith, who then testifies at trial. Bradshaw did take a polygraph, by the way, and his results were inconclusive. But it's the same story here with Tommy Travis. His story is damning, but he's not credible. So, a bit of a version of his story gets passed on to John Bradshaw, and then a version of his story shifts over to Sonia Lucas, who months later says that she did open the door, she did see Mario before he was dead, and that's when he gave her his dying declaration. One of the main reasons that people suspect Carvale Miles in Mario's murder is because the way it's been framed, he fled the area on the day of the murder. And according to Carvale, that's true. He did leave, but he doesn't characterize it as fleeing. We heard some of LeBron Tillman's statement earlier. He was the guy who used to be friends with Carvale until the murder, but because Mario thought Carvale was involved in the robbery, and Tillman's own suspicions of him being a part of the murder, he no longer trusts Carvale. This is the last paragraph from the report on Tillman's interview. Quote, Tillman stated that he felt Miles had something to do with the homicide of Lowe's because Miles was acting funny. Tillman said that he thought Miles had a look of uneasiness about him. Tillman said that he thought it was peculiar that Miles left for Kalamazoo the same day as the homicide and stayed in Kalamazoo for about 2 weeks. End quote. The main reason that Jody says they believe Carvale is responsible for Mario's death is because Jody says that a witness contacted them in prison and said that they gave Carvale a ride to the bus stop that day to go to Kalamazoo, and that Carvale still had the gun with them. According to Jody, they told him he took it to Kalamazoo to get rid of it. I do have the name of that witness, and Jody has also passed that information on to their attorneys years ago, but to date, no one's been able to make contact, myself included, so just hearsay, it's unconfirmed, but it's worth noting at least. Like I said, Carvale did leave for Kalamazoo on the day of the murder. He left right after he was interviewed by police. So LeBron Tillman does have a point. It was a little odd that Carvale disappeared that day. He was actually on parole at the time, and I believe that would be a parole violation for him to take off and go to Kalamazoo. Typically, you have one house where you have to be, you have a curfew, there's all sorts of restrictions that come with that. But remember, Carvale was interviewed at 9:30 in the morning. And that's where the story about Jody and Leon asking him if he wanted to participate in the robbery came in. And that's pretty much all he tells McKinney. It's a short interview. Then, right after that, Carvale takes off and leaves town. In the months following, his name is all over the case. Several witnesses are saying that he was involved in the murder. A month after the incident, his mom, Glenda, is interviewed. And she had been hearing the buzz going around about Carvale's involvement and offers up an alibi for Carvale without ever being asked. Mentioned this a little bit earlier, this is what she actually said from the report, quote, I spoke to Glenda Miles this date, 12-17-01 at 5 p.m. She first stated that there had been rumors that Carvale Miles may have been involved with the DeMario Lowe's homicide. She told me that Carvale was at her home the entire day on the day Lowe's was killed. Glenda said that Carvale was asleep on her sofa during the time of the shooting. She said that she was sure because she had fried some chicken for herself, Carvale, and her boyfriend. She specified that she fried 6 pieces of chicken, 2 pieces each for the three of them. Glenda stated that Carvale was asleep and would not wake up, so she and her boyfriend ate Carvale's portion. End quote. And that's the report where McGinnis noted at the bottom that he, quote, found it interesting that she had offered this alibi for Carvale when he hadn't asked anything about him. Carvale was finally interviewed as a suspect in March of 2002. In that interview, he said that he had nothing to do with the robbery or the murder. He said that on the night of the murder, he was passed out on his mother's couch. When confronted about Canvas Smith and Tommy Travis identifying him from a photo lineup, he just said they were lying. He then agreed to take a polygraph test, and he passed it. Carvale testified at Jody's trial. His primary purpose for testifying was to connect Jody to the robbery. He told the story of Jody and Leon coming to the house before the robbery to ask if he wanted to hit a lick with them. This is one of the few times where Jody's defense attorney did a good job in cross-examination. He managed to trip Carvale up a bit regarding that visit. So Carvale's mom, Glenda, testified that Jody and Leon were in the house and she found the gold shotgun in the bathroom. And that's what she told them to get out of the house with these guns. But in Carvale's version, the entire conversation happened out on the front porch. White pounced on this and asked specifically about when Carvale saw Leon's shotgun. Carvale said that he pulled it partway out of his pant leg and showed it to him, and then put it back into his pant leg. And that's when White asked about it being in the bathroom. And at that point, Carvale seemed to have remembered that he needed that to be part of the story, and he stumbled through trying to get the gun into the bathroom. Where he ended up was that Jody and Leon stepped into the bathroom with the door open to show him their guns, and his mom saw that happen, which is not even close to what Glenda said happened. Carvel's story at trial about the night of the murder was that he was across the street from his mom's house partying for most of the night. At one point, Mario and Andre and, quote, some females were there with him. He then says at some point the party broke up and he went home. When he got there, he was waiting on his mother to cook him some food, and he passed out. And that tracks sort of with his mom's testimony. She said that in her police interview that he had been home all day and sleeping on the couch all night. So that's very different, but they both say that he was asleep on the couch while she was cooking the chicken at 11 o'clock at night. This is the part of the episode where we usually bring everything together and make it all make sense. The big reveal. For this last segment, our intention was to cross-reference all of the key witness statements from the night of Mario's murder, from the people who were with Mario in the last hour and minutes of his life. Canvas Smith, Andre Williams, James Blackwell, and Carvel Miles. The goal was to figure out what Mario was actually doing that night, and if Carvel was truly alibied. What we learned is that that is an impossible task. It's impossible to answer those questions because everyone is saying something wildly different. You can't cross-reference any of these statements. No anchors exist at all. There's not a single element of any of the stories that is consistent throughout. So the best that I can do is just to lay it all out for you. Here are the four versions of Mario's evening leading up to his tragic murder. Canvas Smith. She says that she and Mario went to a party store, then they picked up Andre Williams at the crime scene at 784 Broadway. They drove around for 15 minutes, and then they dropped Andre back off at the crime scene. Then Mario took her home, said he had something to do, but he would be back. Andre Williams. Andre testified at the trial that he was drinking alone with Mario on Lake Street on the night of the murder. Like, literally, on the street. And then they split up. Andre got out of the car and walked away, and Mario drove away. No canvas, no party, no nothing. And this is where we find the most frustrating exchange in this entire trial transcript. Quote, Cotter, so you had that conversation, and ultimately you left and DeMario left too? Andre. DeMario told me he was going to... Cotter cuts him off. Not what he said, it's hearsay. You can't testify to that. End quote. God damn it. I mean, who knows if he was going to tell the truth, but Andre was about to say what Mario told him he was going to do right before he got killed, and it wasn't the defense that objected. The prosecutor cut him off to avoid the hearsay testimony. But anyway... Andre says he and Mario were hanging out on Lake Street, and Mario drove away. No canvas, no house party. Then we have James Blackwell, Mario's cousin. He says that Mario was hanging out at his house drinking with Mario, Andre, some other guys, and, quote, some females. Mario left, and 45 minutes later, he heard the shots. I always assumed that canvas was part of the some females, but she doesn't say anything about going to the Blackwell's house. In her version, she and Mario were just driving around with Andre, who was picked up and dropped off at the crime scene. And in Andre's version, he's drinking alone with Mario over on Lake Street. Then we have Carvel's story that he's hanging out with Mario's family, that would be the Blackwells, drinking with them, Mario and Andre, and the party broke up and he went home and passed out. But James Blackwell, in his statement, he's talking about Carvel. The majority of his statement is talking about Carvel. But then, when he gets to the party, he does not include Carvel in the group of people hanging out at his house, and he doesn't say anything about the party breaking up before the murder. So, that's it. That's the story. No big bombshell, no mic drop. Eric and I went into this episode intending to really nail down how or if Carvel had any connection to this murder and hopefully get us a reasonable timeline by dissecting all of these statements. But what we ended up with was just a confusing fucking mess of an investigation. Yeah. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weber. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.